bathing standards.
The House Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. We're going to go a little out of order and get a work session done on a bill real quickly. And with that, I'm going to open work session House Bill 3047. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure we heard on April 1st. It's the one that directs TriMet to implement a pilot project to use volunteer greeters on light rail vehicles to improve user safety. We have in your packets two amendments. The first, a -1, changes the requirement for greeters on light rail vehicles to a requirement for greeters on light rail platforms, changes the purpose of the greeters, and also addresses some concerns. The -2s require a report to the Legislative Assembly. You have fiscal and revenues on both of these. There's minimal expenditure on the -2s, no expenditure on the -1s, and no revenue on either.
All right. With that, I'm ready to take a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the -1 amendments dated 4709 to House Bill 3047.
Representative Call has moved the -1 amendments to House Bill 3047. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? The -1 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move House Bill 3047 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
The motion on the table from Representative Call is the move House Bill 3047 with the -1 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call a roll.
Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bent?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler? Representative Weiner? Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. The motion passes. And is there someone, would we like to assign Representative Smith?
Oh, this bill? To carry the bill.
Yeah.
By all means.
All right. How many people are there?
There's just two.
Okay, and I have one other public hearing and possible work session that I don't think will be very complicated, so I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on 3047. Open the public hearing on 2564. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, as written, allows a person to provide odometer disclosure forms to Department of Transportation, et cetera, et cetera. This was introduced as a committee bill. We are not considering the bill as written today. We have two amendments that would replace the measure. The first, the -1s in your packet, amends statutory requirement that DEQ keep its motor vehicle pollution control system inspection centers open until 9 on some days to require that some centers stay open beyond 5 o'clock p.m. on some days of the week. That's the -1s, and DEQ is here to speak to those. The -2s also replace the measure. They change statutory exemption from offense to failure to follow our rail crossing procedures for high-risk vehicles under ORS 811.465 sub 4 by specifying the exemption applies only to business districts and by deleting the provision stipulating exemption applies only on roads designated speed 20 miles per hour or less. And I believe Bob Russell is here to speak to those.
And with that, Andy Ginsberg and Bob Russell, if you'd come up.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, members, or good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with DEQ, and I'm here to present to you an amendment to House Bill 2564, and I hope you have the amendment in front of you. The purpose of this amendment is to provide some flexibility for our vehicle inspection program in scheduling our hours of operation. Specifically, it removes a requirement in our existing statute that requires us to stay open until 9 o'clock p.m. On some nights, and it gives us the flexibility to still have extended hours, a requirement to still have extended hours, but the flexibility to schedule those hours according to demand. The 9 p.m. statute was written to ensure that customers have access to our vehicle inspection program during evening hours, and we absolutely support that goal. But over the years, we found that as the evening wears on, we have fewer and fewer customers, and staffing during those late hours where there's very little demand for our stations makes it more difficult for us to have adequate staffing during peak hours when we have high demand. And that means we can't keep all of our lanes open, and that means our lines get longer. So it's a trade-off between providing good service in the evening and also good service during the rest of the day. So the amendment is very simple. It eliminates the 9 o'clock time and replaces it with a requirement to stay open beyond 5 o'clock p.m. Representative Berger asked me how would we ensure that we could still have adequate evening hours, that we wouldn't just close at 5:01 p.m. for example. And my response to that is that we actually survey our customers regularly as one of the key performance measures that we report to the Ways and Means Committee every biennium is key performance measure number one, and it measures our customer service in several of DEQ's programs, and the vehicle inspection program is part of that. And in the survey, we ask customers how they rate our timeliness, our accuracy, our helpfulness, our expertise, and the availability of information. The vehicle inspection program regularly rates very high. Our overall ratings are in the high 80s and 90s in terms of positive results for that survey. So if we were to change our hours in a way that created problems on either end, that we had huge lines during the day or that we had no availability of service in the evening, you can be sure we would hear about it, and we'd be reporting that to the Ways and Means Committee. So with that, I'd like to just urge your support for the amendment, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions on this amendment? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I think my amendment is actually simpler than Andy's. If you look at lines 21 and 22, what it does is it changes the definition of industry crossing tracks. And the issue that we have is at the federal level, we have one definition of when a truck transporting hazardous materials has to stop before they cross the railroad tracks. At the state level, we have a different definition. So what we're doing with this amendment is we're synchronizing the two definitions so that we know when we have to stop. Everybody knows when we have to stop because the rules will be the same. And that's really all this issue is all about. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Russell?
Yes, no.
No questions? All right. So, since I see no other questions, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2564. Yep.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to 2564, dated 4/13/09.
Representative Call has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2564. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? No objections. Amendment is adopted. Representative Call.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2564, dated 4/15/09.
Thank you. Representative Call has moved the dash two amendment to House Bill 2564. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2564 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Call has moved House Bill 2564 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bent?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Weidner? Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. The motion passes. House Bill 2564, as amended, will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And with that, I am. Is there anyone feeling really like they want to carry this bill to the floor?
I'll do it if no one else wants to. I'm okay.
Representative You're willing to let him
do
it?
I'll do it. No, Representative Berger, I don't.
Representative Call will be the carrier, and we won't close the work session on the House Bill 2564.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Schaffler to be recorded as, to record his vote on House Bill 3047.
Thank you. Representative Bailey has moved to suspend the rules to allow Representative Schaffler to vote on House Bill 3047. Any objections? Seeing none, Representative Schaffler, how do you vote?
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3121. And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, House Bill 3121, was referred by the House Committee on Education. It requires the Department of Transportation to design a Keep Kids Safe registration plate in consultation with the State Commission on Children and Families. Provides that, in addition to any other fee authorized by law, upon issuance of the Keep Kids Safe registration plate and upon renewal of the plate of a vehicle, the department shall collect a surcharge of $16 per year of registration. Net proceeds from the surcharge collected will go to the Commission's account for child abuse prevention programs.
Thank you, Patrick. And with that, Representative Wisnett, would you please come forward?
Megan.
And Hillary Saraceno. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable committee members. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, District 53, and proud to have a friend and colleague sitting here with me, Hillary Saraceno, who is Executive Director of the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing this bill today, House Bill 3121, the Keep Kids Safe License Plate Bill, comes to you at the request of the Coalition of County Commissions on Children and Families. Each member of this committee has a commission on children and families in your county. And this bill addresses, the funds from this would go to child abuse and neglect, which is a big problem in the state of Oregon. I'm upstairs passing bills in the judiciary today concerning child abuse. Last year, there were over 26,000 reports of child abuse and neglect, 7,227 founded case. Every day, on the average, 19 children are abused and neglected. I'm proud the chair does a good job in telling her committee members not to endorse license plate bills, but I knew that trying to get sponsorships, but we were still successful in getting 39 members of the House as co-sponsors on this bill. The bill is no cost to the state. We have a firm commitment for the $23,000 to produce the plates. I thought my legislative assistant was going to join me. Today's her birthday, and the only thing she wants for her birthday is this committee to pass this bill.
I think Representative Wisman has gotten off cheap this year.
That's the kind of person she is. She wants a bill for the abused children. It's not for the abused. You want to prevent abused children. That's the objective of this money. So, Madam Chair, you've got a lot of testimony and a lot of work to do today. I have some upstairs, and if you have specific questions to me, I do appreciate the committee. I know the difficult task you have. I think this is important. I think this is the plate that needs to be selected. The chair knows I tried hard and members of this committee last year to get this brought forth. And it does come from not just my county that Hillary's representing, but all of your counties have sent you letters of support and talking about child abuse and how this could help the prevention of that. So please consider this very seriously, and you're going to have a lot of strong advocates talk to you today about child abuse and how this passing this bill for the license plate could help them. As you all know, the situation we're in and the funding is going to be very, very difficult. And this allows citizens of Oregon, and I've already pledged at least one plate that I will buy to put on Josie's Mustang so for the kids. So any questions for me, Madam Chair? Otherwise, I'll go back and work for the people in judiciary.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you could put that on Josie's license plate, on her Mustang, and we could probably put one on the front and the bear, Smokey the Bear one on the front. Would that work, or the back?
Madam Chair, and good Representative Boone, who's my friend, I think this committee, I trust this committee, and you'll look at where the funds are going for this bill, and I hope that I have confidence you'll make the right vote.
Thank you. Follow up. And I thank you, Representative Wisnett, for doing this too. This is a issue great, dear to my heart. It's Child Abuse Prevention Month. And yes, we depend on our commissions to do the hard work in our districts. And it's not all hard work. It is hard work, but it's good work. And it really helps us do our job, too, knowing that there's somebody right there on the ground, and they do good work. And I support them 100%.
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, bless you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions, so thank you for coming down today.
Good luck.
Yeah. Hillary Saraceno with the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families. Thank you, Madam Chair Beyer and the committee for the opportunity to speak to you today. I come from Central Oregon, and I have a great appreciation for outdoor recreation. Our economy depends on it. We have people that come from everywhere to enjoy our lakes, our rivers, our mountains, our skiing, and our biking. I have a husband who fly fishes, and he has a salmon plate. That wouldn't change. I have a generic plate. That would change. I travel to a lot of states. I haven't been to everyone, but I traveled a lot. And every time I come home, I have a great appreciation and reaffirmation that we live in one of the most beautiful states in the country. And we have some of the greatest natural resources anywhere. We truly are a Pacific wonderland, from our water, our Cascade Range, and our Badlands and beyond. But I ask you to consider, when you consider all of the resources that we have, as I talk about this, and I want to share with you this plate that was drawn by an 8-year-old boy, and I won't tell you the story about it. There's a story behind it, but I don't have enough time to share that with you. And I share it with you not because it would be the plate that we would have, but more because of what it says. And essentially what it says is, children are our greatest resource. And I ask, why don't we have one for children? We do have, speaking of which, since this won't be the design, we do have an award-winning graphics artist that would help us do a competition so that we would have an appealing plate that would be, so that we have given some thought in terms of the design, and we have someone willing to volunteer their time. So consider the facts. Research shows that children who are abused and neglected more likely will be challenged and fail academically. They're more likely to have substance abuse problems in their preteens, their teens, and beyond. And 33% of abused children will more likely end up in our community justice system for a felony conviction for a violent crime. The tragedy is child abuse can be prevented. But the resources for child abuse prevention and intervention are seriously being challenged. Now, a plate won't completely backfill or offset any cuts that these programs are receiving. But just for one example, CASA is receiving an estimated 30% cut in its budget. And if you look at the cost of one, what used to, I don't know the current, but the most recent number I have is that it's an estimated $96,000 a year to incarcerate one juvenile. That's almost double what we currently give our CASA program in whole, just to put the money in perspective a little bit. The other thing I'd like to share is that 100% of the children in Deschutes County that had a court-appointed special advocate were not re-abused last year, or the year before, or the year before that. So it's a program that works, and we have several that are at risk right now. So how will the plate be paid for? Representative Wisnett, we've got that one covered. Will people buy it? That's always the question. We did a survey of 1,500 people, and 88% said they would buy the plate. That more than covers the investment made to get the plate purchased. 33 states in our country have a license plate for children, of which much of the funding goes towards child abuse prevention. Of those, we dug a little deeper because we agree that there's probably a saturation point with license plates, and that is something to be considered, and I applaud Oregon's being conservative in terms of the number of plates that it has. However, looking at all the states that said there are two, one that has 64 plates available to it, and that's in Indiana, and it's a kids' first specialty plate, and they raised an average of $1.275 million every year. Another one, Washington, has 44. They don't do quite as well. They get a little over 100,000. So we did a little research to find out why they don't do as well as Indiana, because we would like to be like Indiana. And part of the difference is they have a marketing plan, which is why we have done our homework to develop a marketing plan and, again, have a graphic designer who's willing to help us with this. We have a professional body in Deschutes County that's called Opportunity Knox. It's about 18 groups of 12 to 18 professional members who said they would help market it. We have a local bank that has franchises around the state who said they would help put it out there. We have a local franchise that, again, has businesses around the state who have also agreed. However, that was last session, and since that time he has passed away, so we're still trying to work out with the new owners whether that would still be the case. So we have given this some thought. We do have a marketing plan. We also have, as Representative Wisnett shared, 36 counties, Commission on Children and Families, that have a citizen labor board, an army of people, volunteers who will go out and help make this happen. There will be an internal motivation to help make that happen. So, we're experiencing budget cuts like never before, as you're very aware. This has no impact on the state general fund. It provides dollars for child abuse prevention and intervention for programs that are experiencing extreme 30 to 50% cuts in resources, and it will save the state money in the long run. It supports prevention and intervention, and for every dollar invested, saves an average of $7. And with the loss of resources, in addition, there will be a decline in resources or in expenditure for dropouts, substance abuse, and cost for incarceration. And lastly, child prevention and intervention does save lives. So I thank you for this opportunity. Get any questions?
Any questions?
Oh, I'm supposed to put up my sign. The other one says, stop and nothing to prevent child abuse.
I don't see any other questions. I do have a quick question. When you were researching the plates in other states, did you also look at the number of licensed vehicles there were in those states as a comparison of how many?
Yes, that's why we came up with the examples, because we know that's a concern, and we share that. But we looked at the extreme, 64 and 44 plates for citizens to choose from in those other states and some others that still do very well. All 33 states, the plates do well. And it's sort of all over the map in terms of how many each state has. Those were the two extremes that we wanted to point out, that I hope, you know, thinking Oregon will never have 44 or 64 to choose from. But we do have one for square dancers that I've never seen, but apparently we have one. So my question is, why don't we have one for kids?
Okay. And I guess just to clarify, Representative Berger.
I'm trying to furiously read the bill here, and maybe you can answer the question. So the plate money is deposited by DMV into a children and families account, and then how is it distributed?
It's distributed through the Commission on Children and Families to the locals according to the number sold in each county. And it's given with the concept that rather than having it be, because we talked about this in concept when we were developing the bill, should it be for CASA, should it be for a specific child abuse program? And we opted not to, because every county's needs are different. And so in one county, that may indeed be where they want to put their child prevention resources, but it would go to the local commission and the local citizen board to help decide what child prevention efforts are the best to invest in with the money that they get.
Yes, follow up.
So who keeps track of where they were purchased, DMV?
Yes, and I don't know all of the details. I know that's been researched, but if you'd like that information, I can get that back to you in detail.
I'm just anticipating that there would be a fiscal here. That's all.
And as with other plates, there's a part of the fee goes towards paying that cost. So not the whole amount goes to the local or to the state commission. There's a fee amount taken off that's calculated in terms of how much they need for the administration of that, because we have other plates that happens with.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I should mention as answer to the question, we do have, this measure was given a minimal fiscal impact statement when it came out of the Education Committee.
Thank you.
For what it's worth, Madam Chair.
No other questions from the panel. I guess when I asked my question, and maybe you answered it and I didn't quite get it, but not how many license plates other states have, but how many actual licensed vehicles they have that they're selling to, which could impact the amount of money that's raised.
Yes, the population can play, and I know Indiana has a larger population, but we have a higher medium income. So there's other factors in there that are hard to anticipate, but we did not actually look at the number of registered vehicles.
Because I would think that would play definitely more than the income, is that the more vehicles you have that you're putting licenses on, the more money you can raise as opposed to a person's income.
Yes.
So I was just curious if you had that information. So given that, thank you.
Welcome.
I don't see
thank
any
you,
other questions.
Madam Chair, Committee. Thank you so much.
Yes. Elaine Knobs and Pamela Butler. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Elaine Knobs, and I'm the Director of Prevention and Education at the Kids Center. The Kids Center is a regional child abuse intervention center. There's 19 child abuse intervention centers in the state, so each of your districts has a child abuse intervention center that serves suspected child abuse victims in every location in Oregon. Last year at the Kids Center, which is in Bend, we saw almost 700 kids. That's 700 kids that walked through our doors for suspected physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, and emotional abuse. Kids from throughout Central Oregon. So this picture was created by one of those kids. It says, "I was scared." So this little girl experienced sexual abuse. And this is what I'm here today to ask you to help prevent. So in 2007, nearly 11,000 confirmed incidents of child abuse, like the incident that this girl experienced, happened in Oregon. And that's 11,000 of kids feeling scared, confused, hurt, and all sorts of the gamut that it happens when kids are abused. So according to a federal study, the actual number is of actual incidents of child abuse is three times the number of reports. So that 11,000 incidents in Oregon actually is probably more than 33,000 incidents that happen to kids. So that's more than the population of Oregon City. 33,000. So that city, you know, if we think of a city full of victims, that city of victims costs our state nearly $800 million each year. Our state, according to a U.S. Justice Department study. Preventing child abuse saves money, and we all know what's going on with our economy and our budgets. And we know this is something that actually saves money and protects kids and saves lives. So a Federal Reserve Bank study found that for every dollar that was invested in preventing child abuse, $5 was saved. So those 700 kids that walked through the Kids Center's doors last year ask you and all the constituents in your districts, of all the child abuse intervention centers, of all the kids that walk through their doors, to help protect them and help protect the next cycle of victims from walking through their doors, and to really help drive out child abuse with the power that you have. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Butler, and I am here today representing, although a little bit older now, the abused, neglected children of Oregon and youth, children and youth. We can't forget the older ones. I feel really fortunate and lucky to be able to be here today representing a population whose voice is often unheard at any table. At age 7, I remember very clearly being shoved into the back of a police car and speeding away while my mother faded into the background. And I'm 24 now, and our relationship never recovered from that trauma or the traumas that happened before the removal. I spent the next 11 years after that bouncing from foster home to foster home until I graduated from high school and was left in left care for good. After 8 caseworkers, 7 foster homes, more therapists than I can remember, different school districts, I was sent out to the world to survive. Now that I'm out, and I have to add here, my last years in care, I actually did receive a CASA, and she changed my life, and without her, I would not be alive. And any support that the Commission can give the CASA programs, I support without a doubt. But now that I'm out, I work in public policy, and I do advocacy, and I work with youth who are in foster care, and I hear this word all the time, prevention, prevention, prevention. And I keep thinking, I really wish it had been a part of my life. Because to me, prevention means healing families, it means kids that stay at home, and it means changing lives. And because of that, I urge you to support this House Bill 3121 and give the Oregonians a chance to decide where their hearts are and put their money where their hearts are. And I urge you to support this not because of me, because it's too late now, but for all the other 7-year-old girls and 7-year-old boys who just want to be safe and they just want to be loved. Thanks. If you have any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for coming today. Then I think I have Jeff and Ann Stevenson. Stevenson.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the Transportation Committee. We are Ann and Jeff Stevenson, residents of McMinnville, Oregon, and facilitators and facilitator instructors for Stewards of Children at the Child Sexual Abuse Prevention Program for Adults developed by Darkness to Light, a South Carolina-based not-for-profit. Their website is www.darkness2light.org. This program was awarded the 2007 National Crime Prevention Program of the Year by the National Crime Prevention Council. Very few children ever tell anyone about being sexually abused. However, a compilation of national studies of adults looking backward on their childhoods have determined that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before their 18th birthdays. These are conservative estimates. 90% or more Oregon crime assistance experts suggest, more like 98% in Oregon, are abused by someone the child knows and trusts. Think about prevention efforts we would put in place if 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys were struck by cars before they graduated from high school. Sexual abuse can be equally damaging. Children who are sexually abused may blame themselves, have trouble trusting others, feel hopeless or have a sense of doom, fear healthy affection, feel powerless, have body sensations that feel traumatizing, feel loss of relationship with parents and family, live in constant secrecy, feel tremendous shame, hate themselves, fear being in relationships, even friendships, and doubt that they're worthy of being loved. Child sexual abuse exists in an atmosphere of fear, secrecy, and denial. Children who keep their abuse a secret or tell and are not believed are at far greater risk than the general population for psychological, emotional, social, and physical problems, often lasting into adulthood. These problems include, but are not limited to, drug and alcohol abuse in 70 to 80% of the cases, young males with suicidal thoughts, about 50%, and attempts, about 20%, eating disorders in young girls, school problems, major depressive disorder, sexual promiscuity and teen prostitution, and violently victimizing other children in about 30% of the cases. In short, child sexual abuse is a core problem in society today. Diminishing the prevalence of child sexual abuse would have dramatic impact on crime, substance abuse, and public health. There are also monetary issues. A Department of Justice study in 1993 determined that the tangible cost of intervention and treatment for a single substantiated incident of child sexual abuse is $14,350, adjusted to 2007 levels. These costs are paid by taxpayers. In the U.S., we spend $3.4 billion a year for immediate costs of child sexual abuse. Long-term expenses attributable to child sexual abuse add $35 billion annually. These numbers do not include the additional costs of teen pregnancy intervention, psychological treatment for substance abuse, or suicidal intentions. The savings from primary prevention, stopping child sexual abuse before it happens, can be enormous. Fortunately, there are proven prevention programs. Just as an example, Stewards of Children, an evidence-based second-party evaluated program, demonstrated in 2005 a very significant 36% increase in knowledge and attitudes upon completion, with an equally impressive retention with less than 10% decrease in knowledge over 2 months. These are statistically very significant results. Further second-party reviews are underway, sponsored by the Center for Disease Control, with results expected by the end of this year. Effective prevention programs, like Stewards of Children, can break that cycle of fear, secrecy, and denial. The Stewards of Children program includes a personal workbook that costs about $10, so the program is not free. National estimates conclude that every adult trained in child sexual abuse prevention can have significant impact on prevention for 10 children. That means that if we can avoid the abuse of just one child, saving that $14,350, we could turn that into a training of about 1,400 adults, providing protection for about 14,000 children. In 2007, there were 1,012 founded cases of child sexual abuse. The difference is the 1,012 and the 11,000, they're talking about all forms of abuse. I'm talking purely about child sexual abuse. Is that me?
No. It's somebody's cell phone if there's one on the building.
Applying the $14,350 average per incident cost, that is about $16 million in taxpayer costs just for the initial intervention by law enforcement and upfront treatment. Coincidentally, we in the Bend group also studied Indiana. We are from Indiana. Many states, 33, have raised funds through specialty license plates, such as the one proposed by Representative Wisnett. The state of Indiana has a Kids First license plate since 1996. Over the past 7 years, Indiana, with a population of 6.4 million, I'm sorry, Chairwoman Beyer, I don't have the motor vehicle, but just population numbers, it's about 70% above Oregon's population. And with apologies, there is a typo in this letter. It has generated an average of $1.275 million per year for child abuse prevention, despite the state having 64 specialty license plates. One of those plates is for the Indianapolis Colts. I'm sure that's a very important plate for the state. If Oregon could generate similar prorated results, the plate could put about $1 million towards child abuse prevention. That would train about 100,000 adults in child sexual abuse prevention, which coincidentally is about the tipping point towards making child sexual abuse part of our everyday culture.
Prevention.
Hillary mentioned the marketing program. Here's a small example of that. The Prevent Child Abuse Indiana puts these out by the thousands. It's just a small keychain that has their plate on the back, how to get the plate. It's just a small example of their marketing program. The statistics and facts about child sexual abuse that we've cited in this report may be shocking and unsettling, but the fact is prevention can and does work when the proper funding is in place. Please support this extremely important initiative. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a little bit of a question and maybe a little bit of a vent, and glad to see that I have people from my district here today. It's kind of nice when you get people up here. So, but in Yamhill County, how many cases do we deal with there roughly that go through
I'd have to
your office?
Refer that to Juliet's house probably, but it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 350, I believe, something like that magnitude. It's probably something like that. And it's comparable numbers to what Elaine talked about.
Those numbers. County. We're only one county.
Yep.
And those numbers could be much higher because I have a very close family member that went through this and didn't say anything till she was 35, 40 years old. So I think this is something important for us to do. We have a lot of plate bills that come before here, and I know our chair doesn't like all the plate bills and because they all sound like great ideas, but something I'm an advocate for is kids. And Madam Chair, if I may vent, I think we really should look at two of them, this one and the fallen, it's not officers, whatever, fallen firemen or officers or whatever public we call safety. Them that plate now, safety, public safety plate. But I think this one's a very important one to do to help out departments like this because it's people's choice. It's not a tax on them. They have the choice on whether or not they can get the plate. And because I'm a little frustrated because I introduced a bill that dealt with child rape and it got killed because of a fiscal. And so this is really rubbing me wrong hearing this. And if nothing else, I could have a little bit of gratitude if we move this plate forward. So
thank you.
And I'll get off my soapbox.
That's okay.
Any would the committee questions? Have an interest in a copy of the stewards program? It footnotes much of the statistics I talked about today. If you'd like to have a copy, I'd be very, very happy to leave one.
Yeah,
behind.
We can't afford to leave 25, unfortunately.
All right.
Too expensive.
We'll put it in the
website's
records of the
here.
Bill.
Yeah. Hmm?
Website there.
Website. They have the website on here.
Okay. Do you want to add anything?
I'm just eye candy, I guess.
Well, you're doing a very good job of that, right? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Committee, we do have some written testimony from ODOT. They are here, but unless you have questions for them, they'll come.
Is it in here somewhere?
It should be.
Yeah, so anything grabbing you there? Okay. With that, I'm going to go ahead, and I don't have anyone else signed up, and close the public hearing on House Bill 3121. And thank you all for coming. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3252. And Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3252 requires first-time applicants for Oregon driver license who are not previously licensed in another jurisdiction to certify they have at least 20 hours of driving experience with a certified driving training instructor. It changes the requirement for issuance of driver license to individuals under 18 from 50 hours supervised driving plus completion of a traffic safety education course or 100 hours of supervised driving experience to a new requirement for 20 hours of driving experience with a certified driver training instructor. The measure establishes a minimum of 40 questions for driver license examinations to include at least six of which must pertain to safe operation of a vehicle around pedestrians and bicyclists. It creates a requirement for completion of a questionnaire similar to a driver license examination for renewal of driver licenses and directs the department to mail questionnaires to drivers whose licenses are soon to expire.
Thank you, Patrick. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and ask Representative Reed if he would like to come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remaining members of the committee, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I'll try to not take it personally
bad.
That on the opening of the bill with which I'm associated, there seemed to be a mass exodus. I'm hopeful that we can just introduce the concept here. I think, first off, it's a pleasure to be back in front of the Transportation Committee, although a bit bittersweet, so I had the pleasure of being a member of this committee in the last session and have missed the conversations that often happen here. Let's get back to the bill. What I'm hoping to do is just introduce the concept here. I think given the relative lateness of the hour on Friday and of the date in session, there are some remaining questions to be answered in the bill, but that it has a solid motivation and underpinning. Your committee administrator did an able job summarizing it. And I think what I would just add to that is the piece of it that particularly interested me. In the last session, I had the chance to work on a number of bills related to transportation safety, and it occurred to me during that process and as I've watched the implementation of those concepts that as good as they are and as well intended as they are, they're not worth very much if people don't know about them. I, speaking for myself, having gotten my driver's license years ago, it's not an automatic thing for people to review safety information, the laws of the state, let alone things that we change, as they should be. So that's really the motivation of this bill, to prompt people to have a reason to refresh themselves and to stay up to date on laws that change. It'd be my hope that as we go forward, we make that easy on people. The bill talks about, I believe it talks about the option for the test to be open book, using sort of a colloquial term, and I'd certainly like to see it available online. The idea, again, is to have people required to review the laws of the state, particularly those that that have changed. So that's the motivation of the bill. I know there are a number of questions about how it works, but I hope that we can introduce that concept and continue to work on it, perhaps in the interim and into the next session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question.
Yeah, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Representative, for coming on down here. How many first-time applicants for driver's license? I had driver's license when I was a kid. My daughter's going to take it this summer, probably, but... How many people don't go through this experience of a professional driving instructor?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I think it's a good question, and frankly, I don't know the answer. The piece that I got particularly interested in was the renewal testing piece. That's what motivated me to be part of this bill. But I suspect some of the people who might follow me in testimony would have a better number on that. No problem.
Thank you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and. Representative Reed, I'd be happy offline to have as many conversations as you want about railroad grade crossings and weight mile enforcement if you really do miss the committee that much.
and license plate.
Me too.
But to the bill.
It also feels a little bit like I'm here in the revenue committee, too.
I just want to say that I think the intention behind this bill is a great one, and I think it also sets us apart from other states where my experience has been that there is a direct relationship between the amount and the quality of the instruction and what happens on the roadways. Having lived in states where there actually is almost no drive portion of the test or certification of driving instruction as is in this bill, I have to say it makes me feel safer on the road being in Oregon to know that we have a bill like this before the legislature. So I'm glad you brought it forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Widener and then Berger.
This is a little bit of a comment and probably to help Representative Schaffler out a little bit, but everybody has a father who is a professional driving instructor. So that's my statement.
Representative Berger.
Two comments, if you don't mind. And, Representative Reed, this is the best bill I've seen all session, and that is not a serious remark. And I want it noted that when my favorite bill comes before your committee, I want you to note that I was in the room to hear all of your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Representative Berger.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Reed, having two children who have their driving permits, I want to know if the 20 hours, the 20 hours is actual hours or just how long it seems during the car.
I'm sure, Representative Benz, I suppose that depends on what your definition is and what you think it might be.
Oh, yeah. Well, Madam Chair, I can tell you it seems like it's been a lot more than 20 hours. I think it was just two. Mm. So.
Madam Chair, we have had some fun, but I can have one serious question.
Okay. Boone, do you want to?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And like our friend Representative Schaffler says, he has green votes and tree votes and gravel votes. I have prevention votes, and I look at this as a prevention vote. This is preventing future bad drivers. I totally like this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
A 100 hours seems like an awful lot. Are you requiring professional training of 100 hours in this bill? Is that what my understanding is? No.
And Chair Representative Berger, I'm looking to see if I find 100 anywhere. The one I know about is 20.
I'm looking at the SMS.
Patrick.
I'm Chair Representative Berger. The 100 hours referenced in the staff measure summary is a current requirement. The current requirement is that a person perform 50 hours of supervised driving and complete a safety course or complete 100 hours of supervised driving.
That's why I'm confused. Okay, got it. No,
thank you.
No other questions over here?
I have several, but then Representative Widener would have to respond to all of them.
You can take them outside for you.
I'm going to prevent that, Representative.
It must be Friday.
Representative Bailey.
and to Representative Berger's point, I actually just have a technical question. I'm just curious. Representative Reed, will this apply to me and Representative Barton? I'm just curious.
It's an interesting idea for an amendment.
We'll have it drafted this afternoon. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Representative Reed. Sorry.
Thank you.
Scott Bricker and Doug Paro.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Thanks for having us up here. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance supports this bill. Just from a little bit of context of why this bill is important for all roadway users, in the U.S., about 42,000 people are killed on the roadways every year. That's approximately one commercial airline jet coming out of the sky every other day. Significant impacts, and if that was happening every day, there would be some serious stories in the paper. However, a lot of these issues are effectively swept under the rug, and we think the traffic safety on Oregon's roadways is just an issue of paramount concern. After last legislative session and just a lot of discussion, there's been a lot of work, not only at the driver's side and at the bicyclist side, to try and increase safety for all. And as we were going into looking at this session, we wanted and to support a bill that would take a more comprehensive approach. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance currently works on teaching kids bicycle safety education. We've taught over 50,000 kids in 15 cities around the state a 10-hour course. But our perspective is that almost everyone in Oregon who is of age will get a driver's license at some point. Whether you're a bicyclist, whether you're a driver or someone who walks, that a driver's license is something that almost everyone holds. And we really support having a comprehensive education program at the front end. And that's one of the reasons why we think that this bill would be important. Effectively, everyone who's going to be, whatever mode you're using, you most likely have a driver's license. And if it was a better course, if it was with a trained supervisor, you could go over the variety of modes of travel, including bicycle travel. And the other piece that we are really, that has been talked about more actively in the recent weeks is this retesting part of the bill. And the concept there is that if you get your license when you're 16, and then by the time you're 56, so you know some time has gone by, 40 years have gone by, 20 legislative sessions have gone by, the landscape has changed. There's light rail, there's bus rapid transit, there's streetcar, there are bikes, there's all sorts of different things going on. So again, while most everyone has a driver's license and people are going in every 8 years for renewal, having some refresher course on the variety of modes and the questions we think is a really appropriate safety measure, especially considering the amount of people who are killed and injured on our roadways. So we support this bill. We think it's a really excellent bill. And Doug Parrell from our legislative committee, let's talk about some of the discussions, especially about the second part of the bill, the driving test part of the bill, at the renewal that we've been talking about in the recent weeks.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Doug Parrell. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and I'm also the chair of the BTA's Legislative Committee. As Scott said, we are particularly interested in the testing at the renewal point in terms of those provisions around the bill. For myself, I got my Oregon driver's license in 1965. I just renewed it. That'll take me up to the age of 68, and in that period of time, there's been really very little other than curiosity to prompt me to take a look at the Oregon driver's manual. We think that a written test at the time of renewal is a good way to prompt people to reacquaint themselves with the driving laws, to update themselves on what has changed since 1965 when they may have gotten their driver's license. and think that this is a reasonable approach. We are not particularly wedded to the way in which it's implemented, whether or not it be an online test that motor vehicles would have, whether or not motor vehicles would send a written test to the individual in conjunction with their renewal notice. Quite frankly, we don't have any particular strong feelings in terms of how that might occur, and what we'd want to do is to find the most efficient way to make that happen. In the case of the state of Kansas, which does have, and is, frankly is the one state that we're aware of that has a requirement that people pass a written test at the time that they renew their tests, the way that Kansas handles it is that they mail out the test to in conjunction with the renewal notice. And then the people bring that test back in when they renew their license. In talking with the chief examiner, chief license examiner in the state, a couple points that he made that I thought were somewhat telling. One of them is that Kansas has been doing this, as he described it, forever. And he was very, very enthusiastic about the program. The other thing that he talked about was that when people bring the test in and for some reason they haven't passed it, then what they do is they just ask the person to take the driver's manual and another copy of the test over in the corner and sit down and fill it out again. So there's the immediate option then to try again. But at the same time, in that open book concept, what that testing does is prompt the people to take another look at the driver's manual and acquaint themselves. Quite frankly, in some ways, you know, we are very concerned about the extent to which people are not aware of existing laws. And just as an example, during last legislative session, the legislature passed a bill that established the new requirements for an automobile passing a bicyclist on a road in which the speed limit is 35 miles an hour or faster. And that requirement is basically that the automobile must give the bicyclist the space so that if the bicyclist were to fall over, it would the cyclist would not fall into the path of the motor vehicle. That is a law that this legislature passed last session, but we would guess that there is a minuscule percentage of Oregon drivers who understand that. And certainly from my experience on the road, there is a fairly broad misunderstanding or lack of understanding about those provisions. So in any event, we think that this concept of testing at renewal is a viable approach, is a good approach. It would help to better educate drivers about the responsibilities on the road, and we would welcome the opportunity then to work with motor vehicles and the committee to figure out how to make this work best in Oregon.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you be open for bicyclists taking a test, too, because there's getting to be more bicyclists on the road? And when I was coming into West Salem, there's a guy who came flying off the hill, didn't even stop at the stop sign, went right out into the first lane, out of the bike lane, and came back in because he was going so fast. So I think there's hazards with the bicyclist as well, to where maybe we need to look at licensing and testing for bicyclists who are riding on the roadways as well.
Yeah, Chair Beyer, Representative Widener, definitely an issue that comes up quite frequently at the legislature, both the licensing of bicyclists and the registration of bicycles, which really are two separate...
The testing.
Yeah, so fundamentally two separate issues. When we, again, in the off-session, when we looked at this from our standpoint of strategic approach, we felt that a multimodal license, effectively, when you're 16 or 18, when you're getting your license, that trying to make it more multimodal and have more than just, you know, going through and getting a driver's license, but actually addressing operating on the roadway at one time would be the most effective and efficient way to do it, to actually wrap into that process, not just how to operate a car, but how to, you know, what the rules are when you're walking, so you don't just walk out in the middle of the street, when you're bicycling, and whatever modes, you know, those are really the three primary modes. So that's the approach when we look at the first part of the bill that we really believe that, and in Europe, this is really the way it's packaged, that they clump it all into this one program. As it relates to an additional license on people who, you know, currently have their license, our primary concern in that arena is the administrative and the fiscal process and the actual. A lot of people who use bicycles don't necessarily have the financial resources to obtain driver's license. So there are some folks who don't have them. So we're really concerned about adding an additional license. But we do believe that if you were able to create the driver's license today, that was a multimodal license, that most people would be covered, and it would be a really comprehensive approach.
Representative Shoffler?
Test them, tax them, license them, regulate them, inspect their vehicle, make them pay their fair share. Seriously, though, and if I get a multimodal license, can I drive a train? That'd be fun. my serious question, though, is, and this is actually a question for the department, but it popped into my upon examining the bill more closely, and I think your concept has merit, by the way, of at least making us examine and go through and look at the information. But when you look at this, somebody's going to have to provide that. What if the person is illiterate? Who's going to help them through it? What about people who don't speak English or read English? There's a lot going on here, and it's a question for the department, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but it's just there's a lot more here than meets the eye.
Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All I'd want to add was to teach people not to drive in the passing lane on the freeway.
Amen. 8 miles an hour.
And Scott brought up how they do things in Europe. If you do that there, you get a ticket. And people come up behind you. You're always supposed to be on the right lane unless you're passing, or the center lane if the trucks are there, and then that's the passing lane. And it works smoothly. I just wish that we could have that mindset here.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, if I may, there weren't very many freeways when I first got my license, so perhaps that's a problem with in terms of that not been covered.
Are you the one?
No. Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, if I could comment here, the concept here that I didn't get at first about the repeated testing, Mr. Perro and I happen to have known each other a long time, and I've always thought I was younger than him. I'm getting to a new point. I really am. I just am having a little fun because it's Friday afternoon, Doug. This is a much better idea. As the chair knows, I have been trying to get at the fact that we go 8 years between testing cycles, and as we get older, that is, in my mind, a definite problem. And I always get, the anxiety of the older driver having to come in and do all this. And I've tried to squish this down and put it every way I could. It never goes anywhere. I think that I'm going to be combining with Representative Reed, because this, to me, gets at one of my issues. If we are actually testing, it won't be discriminatory against the old people or the young people. If all of us have to be able to show some awareness of new laws and move forward in this sort of retesting, open book though it may be, this would get at the issue that I have with driver's license, which is the 92-year-old woman who said, "I just got it and I'm good for till I'm 100 on my license." And these people are on the same roads as you and I. Thank you,
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that the language on page 4, line 43, that references pedestrians and cyclists is seems to me you don't need that. And I think it actually damages your bill because I think there's lots of folks that are going to look at this and blame those people that ride bicycles for this legislation, and I don't think you need to have that in there. Do you agree, or is there some reason that language is essential to your bill? Representative Reed's bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, one of the things that we have been concerned, maybe this isn't the way to get at it, but we have been concerned about the what we perceive as the low level of knowledge about the responsibilities of motorists operating their vehicles around particularly vulnerable users, people who, if they're hit, then end up paying the price in terms of injury or even death. We certainly would be happy, to work with you, the committee, motor vehicles, to develop a better approach to this, but it has been our interest to try to get more emphasis in the driver's manual and in the written tests on those kinds of issues, because those are the issues that really do endanger us, quite frankly.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. A quick question, I guess, that I have, and now I think I'm distracted and maybe I can't. On the first part, on the professional driving courses, and I know we have someone that might be able to answer this better than you, but when you were looking at this, did you look at a distribution of where these services are, and if this would disadvantage any areas of the state?
Yeah, Representative Byer, Chair Byer, there was a discussion with ODOT, with the Transportation Safety Division and DMV about that issue, and it was clear that if this was to be viable, which is the first part, which is the requirement for driver education for first-time licenses, that it would have to be phased in some way, especially for the more rural parts of Oregon, to allow there to just be enough certified professionals. So there was that discussion. There are no amendments currently on this bill, but yeah, that was recognized as an issue that would have to be addressed. There was, I actually checked with Troy Costales on the question that Representative Schaffler had, which was approximately, he can correct me if I'm wrong, if I got the numbers right, wrong, but approximately 18,000 new driver's licenses are issued a year, and 9,000 of those have gone through some kind of training program. So you are looking at, already half of the people are going through something like this. So when you look at backfilling the rest, I think you'd have to really figure out where the population is not, what that half that's not getting the program, where do they live, and what's the availability of program of educated professionals there, and then where might there need to be more time given to allow there to be professionals certified in those communities. So, yeah, this is an issue that came up.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I have to chime in and agree with my friend, Representative Benz, about the carve-out for 15% for bicycles and pedestrians, because why wouldn't you have a percentage for around schools, for around hospitals, for around playgrounds, or any number of things that I'm not thinking of. I think we have rules and laws on the books relating to all those, and pedestrians and bicycles and motorcycles and ambulances and emergency vehicles, and I think it would help the bill if it removed that carve out and just said 40 questions on safe operation of a vehicle, period. I really think that would help it. And now that does not mean that I think we should not have any questions on that about vulnerable vehicles, pedestrians, understood, school zones, all those things. So, but I agree with my good friend.
If I may, Representative Byer, and Chair Byer, and Representative Schaffler, and Representative Benz, on this issue, we have looked at this issue in the past, and the current driver's test, there are some requirements already. I think there has to be a question about a blind pedestrian. It tends to be that about somewhere between 7% and 15% of the questions already are about the vulnerable roadway, the non-motorized users. So, from a sheer political standpoint, I would concur that the progress this gets you is not necessarily that far in what you see today. The idea behind that was, again, to try and drive this aspect of multimodal transportation just as a concept, so that we're recognizing this is a roadway that there are a lot of different types of users on.
And
I don't see any other questions. My response to that is to get to that balance, though, you're going to have to displace some other type of testing, some other maybe question that is a very important question. So when you start saying you have to have this much of one question in it, what are we going to lose? What other information are we going to lose? So that's my concern, that this is a, if you were doing this, it has to be balanced.
It's a reasonable comments.
Representative Widener, and we're going to have to start moving on. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to help you guys out a little bit and stuff with my perspective looking back at, or looking at this here, every time that it, you come forward, it seems like it's a mandate for cars or against cars and bicycles. The thing that would make a lot of this more stomachable is if you went and addressed your own situation and started looking at regulations for yourself and get your house in order and then start looking outside. That was my point with the guy flying down the hill, and some of these bicyclists, when they see a truck with his right-hand turn signal on and they keep going up there, there's a lot of guys on the other side that are doing bad things. So once you start addressing those as the bicycle community, because you know what the dangers are and the hazards, work on safety there, and then we would be more inclined to, I would be more inclined, I can't speak for all of us, to jump in and help on issues like this.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I can assure you that there are many of us who ride bicycles who are every bit as offended as you are when you see those kinds of situations, because we understand that that kind of behavior affects motorist perceptions towards us. And we do offer training classes. As a matter of fact, this last summer I offered a couple training classes for state employees who are commuting in terms of the rules of the road and how to ride safely on the road and things like that. So we do take that issue very seriously because we understand the impact of that kind of behavior on the rest of us in terms of people's perspectives.
Do you have a question?
I would just like to just counterbalance just a tiny bit that the BTA as an organization works with a lot of community members in Portland to make sure that bicyclists are actually obeying the laws. I'm a beneficiary of a class at Bike Gallery that's funded by those folks who teach commuting and how to interact with cars. They do that at no expense to themselves. They're big supporters of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Yes, there are bicyclists who break the law. They frustrate me as well because they give folks like me who ride my bicycle quite a bit a bad name. And in most of this stuff, there are people on this up here who are frustrated with bicyclists. I'm one of them a lot of the time, but what you guys do in your efforts is very important, and you're definitely not the bad guys in this. In fact, you're doing a lot to try to stem the tide on this stuff, so I hope you don't take any of the comments to heart. We, all of us, I hope, understand that the BTA is an advocate for safe cycling and is really looking out to make sure that cyclists are safe and that cyclists are acting safely. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and just one last parting comment before I pull someone else up is I think as a motorist, I certainly wouldn't want to have to take responsibility for every bad driver out there, too. So I you know, I don't mean to beat up on anybody, but we all have our our problem people. And
thank you.
With that,
thank you very
I'm going to call up Sandra Bishop.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify this afternoon. My name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here representing the Driving School Association of Oregon, DSAO for short. DSAO is the professional association whose members are commercial driving schools. And please don't get confused, also commercial licensees, and it's for trucks. These are the folks who teach everybody to drive. This has nothing to do with commercial trucks, just to clear that up. And our members are commercial driving schools certified by the state of Oregon by ODOT-DMV. Our members go through rigorous training as driving instructors, including meeting extensive continuing education requirements. Our members provide driver's ed to drivers of all ages throughout the state. DSAO supports House Bill 3252. The association supports any requirements for driver education training before licensing for any new drivers, regardless of age. Our predominant interest in driver education in this bill is in the context of teen driver education. Our members strongly support teen driver education. This is where you're going to get the biggest bang for the buck as far as safety on the roads, is training the young folks. It is the foundation for highway safety. We believe it is the intention of the legislature that all teen drivers in the state be given an opportunity to participate in driver education before they receive an Oregon driver license. We support any legislation that will result in more availability of driver education, especially for teens. According to the data referenced in the annual ODOT action plans, the number of providers and the enrollment levels for the state-approved teen driver education programs has steadily declined. I forgot to give you this. Number of providers in the enrollment for state-approved teen driver education programs has steadily declined, and also the number of teens taking the state-approved courses is decreasing substantially. And you'll see from these figures that back in 1998-99, which was the year the graduated or provisional driver's license came in, there were 167 providers in the state offering approved teen driver's education. And currently, there are only 70. So I'm not going to go through all the figures. You can read them for yourself. But in 1998-99, 16,000 students received driver's ed. Currently, the number is approximately 870. So there's definitely something going on. This is a subject for a whole other conversation, not on a Friday, but I wanted to introduce these figures into the record for future reference. So because of the steady decline, one of the reasons we support this bill is because of the steady decline in teens being able to get driver's ed in Oregon. But I also want you to understand, there are plenty of providers in the state. I'm only talking about a decline in teen driver's ed. There are between 20 and 30 commercial driving schools in the state, only because of a lot of regulations and various factors. There are only two or three of those commercial schools who are now providing commercial driver's ed for teens. But the availability of driver education instructors in the commercial schools throughout the state is there. And certainly Scott is correct as far as there is going to be a need to develop more instructors in some of the rural areas. But don't be confused. I'm not saying that there aren't providers there. I'm saying that they're not able to give teens the training. So it's two different things there. And I'd be glad to answer any questions. I did want to clarify a couple of questions Representative Berger asked about the 100 hours. The 50 hours or 100 hours is supervised driving, presumably by a parent or a responsible adult. And I can tell you that most of us would have an ethical dilemma at some point when we were in the car with a teen for 100 hours. And when they presented you the form to sign, you might determine that, gee, I think I'm not very good at math. I did the hours. We did the hours. So that's been a real problem, actually, in the past. So I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I don't know which one was first. Ben? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What's the cost, 20 hours? Do you know what people are going to have to pay to get that training? They don't get it through high school.
Chair Beyer, Representative Bentz, off the top of my head, no. I don't know. It would be different depending on the school and depending on what courses. It is going to be expensive.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Follow-up.
Sorry. Follow-up.
Thank you.
I'm doing well. It's Friday.
Sorry. The when you say expensive, are you talking $50 an hour, $100 an hour? What's expensive?
Representative Bentz, I probably shouldn't have said expensive. My clients are going to probably fire me when I get back home. I shouldn't say expensive, but it's going to cost something. These are professionals who have spent extensive time training and have thousands of hours of experience in driving. So it's going to be some cost. I really don't have at my fingertips the cost that the different driving schools charge. I can get that. I can certainly get that for you.
Follow-up, Manager.
Follow-up.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
I'm actually following up on Representative Bentz because he went the same direction I went. I didn't know he was going to interrogate you, though.
Okay.
So, one of the things I have, because I went through driver's ed at school and then I had children that did, and the cost has definitely went up to where it was like when my one son took it, I was like, wow. The thing I'm curious about, and we do have an insurance person here, there used to be a huge, for grades and student driver, getting the student driver's education and good grades or a good student discount. I saved, it was cut my insurance almost in half, I remember with me, and I don't know on insurance if you would know, are they getting like a 10% discount, 20%? Is there a big decrease in insurance to offset some of this expense?
Chair Beyer, Representative Widener, I wish you guys would ask me some questions I know the answers to.
Well, there is.
I do know that there is oftentimes a discount, but there are so many insurance companies that I would not be able to speak affirmatively about what the percentage break is for any particular company. If there's anyone here that could answer that, that would be great to hear that from them. There's usually an advantage, though, on your insurance.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Paloma? And we might have a little time to talk about Connect Oregon.
We'll try and be quick. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks from the Department of Transportation, and with me is Troy Costales from Transportation Safety, just to cover some of the driver education program questions that you have addressed. House Bill 3252 changes some of how DMV does driver issuance and renewal. For one, it requires that we change the number of questions from 35 to 40. Right now, it's a random sampling. Out of 143 possible questions, we pull 35 questions at random. Seven of the 143 questions are about the safe operation of a vehicle around bicycles and pedestrians. And then the bill asks that DMV send out a questionnaire at renewal. So the same way we would do a notice right now, we would send out a questionnaire saying, fill this out. The bill as written doesn't require that DMV make sure that somebody answered the questions correctly. If we did change it so that they would have to answer the questions or that we would have a test of some sort, that would increase the cost quite significantly. Finally, our current driver education requirement is for teen drivers, when they are trying to get a provisional license, they have to complete 50 hours supervised driving and 50 hours of an ODOT-approved training course or 100 hours of supervised driving. The bill removes that requirement and replaces it with the 20 hours of DMV-certified driving instruction for all new drivers as opposed to chain drivers. Our current driver education program has been quite successful in reducing teen deaths. that is all. I will have Troy cover any other questions you might have about the driver education program and the provisional licensing, because it's his program.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. Paloma, yeah, that might make a difference to me. It lowers it from 50 hours of the manual study, or say that again.
For the student, the teen drivers?
For teen drivers.
For teen drivers, it would lower it from 100 hours of supervised driving, mm-hmm. or 50 hours of supervised and 50, or the ODOT approved course, to only 20 hours of with the commercial drive instructor, who is the standards for DMV doesn't currently have a system for certifying instructors, or it's not as rigorous as the transportation safety's program is.
Follow up. So a course that you would buy, mm-hmm. basically from a driving school, is that DMV certified? It's not DMV certified. It's not the same. What you're talking about.
It's not the same as our current program, as our current approved program.
Final follow-up. Oh. Is that yours is much more rigorous or much less rigorous?
More.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Troy, a little bit of a father of four boys and two of them coming back up to driving age, and Representative Bence is in the same spot. A little closer, but the program that you have in place with now, I've been very impressed with, and I think you've done an exceptional job with what you're doing with teen drivers. So I'm proud of the action you've taken. So that's my comment.
Thank you. No question in that, I guess. Do you have a question? I'm sorry. You're just so quiet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
He's the only polite one on the panel.
I kind of like the idea of retesting, mm-hmm. but I'd like to know what it's going to cost. So does anybody have a wild idea?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, retesting, if we did it online, we would still have to have it in office. We were thinking it would probably be 14 new positions at DMV. So it would be spendy.
And the online system, if we were wanting to go to online?
If we were doing online, Chair Beyer, it would... The estimate that they were able to do, because we'd have to make it work with our old system, which was actually built in the 1960s, so it's not meant to do all the fancy things it does now, would probably be in excess of $1 million.
Any other questions? Representative Berger.
No, I'm not going there. Thank you, Ms.
Okay. I thought I saw a finger go up. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3252 and open an informational hearing on Connect Oregon. Okay. And they should have this down pat. And
don't get that handed out when we gavel out.
Yeah. Do we have someone who can give Kelsey?
Steve Dickey.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. For the record, I'm Jerry Bohard with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm the TDD Division Administrator. And my responsibilities through the Connect Oregon 2 process was to take the project through rulemaking and project selection. And once the commission gaveled down on their projects, turned it over to Highways Local Programs Office to implement the projects. I'll keep it short. I know your time is precious, and I actually think a couple of the documents that you have here will be very helpful. It was a brochure that recently was done out of communications, which highlights some of the projects. It has a number of maps in it. But the map that I also provided to you, we did it a little bit differently, didn't necessarily concentrate on whether it was a Connect 1 or a Connect 2 project, but really tried to identify for you what projects had been completed, what were in design, and what were in construction, so you can get a sense of it visually. And the reasons for the colors represent the five regions within the Connect Oregon process. So I think, as you all are aware, this began back in 2005 with the first multimodal transportation fund, or Connect One, $100 million lottery fund for aviation, marine, rail, and transit improvements. Then back in 2007, there was another $100 million that was allocated. Of that, we've seen a total of 181 project applications, of which 73 were selected for funding. And as of March, so about a little over a month ago, we've had 22 projects that have been completed, 20 of them in the Connect Oregon 1 process and two of them in the Connect Oregon 2 process. The remainder are either under construction or design, as you can see in the map. I think one of the really notable about this program is that we also have seen actually a total investment of $388 million. So for the $200 million that was invested in lottery, we saw $188 million in direct investment from others. And as you recall, both in Connect 1, 15% of the funds went to each of the regions, and in Connect 2, it was 10%. As we went through the rulemaking process, there were a number of considerations that were identified in the bill. They essentially stayed the same through the Connect 1 and the Connect 2 process. In the Connect 2 process, the difference was we added a committee from OECD dealing with ports. The other difference I would highlight in Connect 2 was the sequencing of how we did the work. Essentially had 10 committees in both Connect 1 and Connect 2. Connect 2, what we did was we worked with the modal committees first and had them review the projects, and then we took it to our five region committees, and then to the final review committee. And the final review committee made their recommendations to the commission. The final review committee was chaired by Pat Egan. And while they had anticipated taking 2 days in order to complete that work, we were able to get it done in a day and a half. And the only other thing I think I would note is on page 4 of my testimony, there's a table that really just highlights the number of applications that were submitted, which ones were actually approved. It gives you the numbers, and it also gives you the amount of money broken down by mode. You can see that aviation received $26 million, and I'm referring just to Connect 2, $26.9 million, marine $5.5 million, rail $56.6 million, and transit $10.6 million. So I think with that, other than to say that we look forward, hopefully, to a Connect 3 program. I think we have the system pretty much in place. We've identified an application process. We have all of the guidelines pretty much in place. We moved very quickly on Connect 1 and Connect 2. Within a couple months, we had the rulemaking done. I think within 7 months, we were holding a hearing in front of our commission for them to select projects. So with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Yeah, thank you for this. By the way, this this handout is actually really, really pretty accessible. I like it when there's information. I can actually see what things say, like at a glance, so I appreciate that, first of all. I want to dig just a tiny bit in into some of the... Sorry. I wanted to dig just a little bit into the transit numbers a bit, and I want to know, I guess some of us are, I guess my big question is looking at transit as a Connect Oregon component. So I think oftentimes when we're looking at transit within the Connect Oregon program, we're looking at it as an intra-community mode of transportation, and oftentimes part of my first question is down the list a bit, on the level of priority, because it's really within one community. That's the first question. The second question is, President Obama came out yesterday and announced the importance of passenger rail, creating transit corridors. Pacific Northwest is one. I've been in touch with Kelly Taylor in the rail division, and it seems like there's a very promising opportunity to utilize the Oregon Electric line, use that entire corridor, connect Portland all the way down to Eugene for, you know, less than one quarter of the cost of the Columbia River crossing, for example. There's federal dollars on the table for it, and I'm wondering what you feel is moving forward into the transit world, instead of thinking intra-community, but actually moving to inter-community transportation and transit, what you think the viability of high-speed passenger rail is in competing for these Connect Oregon dollars, and how we can draw down more federal dollars since this has become a priority of the Obama administration. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Representative Kale. I'm actually not sure that I'm the right person to answer those questions. I haven't been involved in passenger rail, but I would say with regards to Connect Oregon, the idea is for connections between modes. And with regards to transit in particular, I would say that through the Connect 2 process, it was one that I think there was a little struggle with for people to understand. But I would say that ultimately transit did very well in that of the $15 million that they requested in projects, they received $10 million, which actually from a percentage standpoint was higher than any of the other modes.
And I don't mean to imply that transit didn't do well. In fact, you know, we have a letter here from the mayor of Gresham about a station that's in my district that I'm ecstatic actually pulled down Connect Oregon funds. So I'm not being critical in the least. I guess what I'm asking is, how do we move further faster?
Yeah. Chair Beyer, Representative Kale. I think one of the limitations of this is the use of operational funds, and that, I think, is probably one of the key issues for transit, which makes that more difficult, and that's kind of a bonding situation. I'm not sure that you can fix that in the Connect Oregon process. I think what's important is that all of these are different tools that we have and different funding mechanisms that we have, and the work that we're doing in the freight plan and the work that Kelly Taylor is doing with her rail study, I think all of those will help us to identify which are the most efficient and effective projects, and I think that's been part of the learning process that we've had through the Connect 1 and Connect 2, that we're going to be, I think, as we do this more often, be able to identify the best projects as they come forward. And if there's a continuity to it, then we'll have those waiting in the wings, and I think that's been probably one of the limitations that we've had in the Connect 1 and the Connect 2 process. They've been kind of quick opportunities that people haven't been able to kind of put the thoughtful process planning aspect into it that you're suggesting.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions down here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Call's question raises another one, and I guess the issue is, when you were allocating these funds in the Connect Oregon process, was there, I'm not quite sure how the number of people that use the mode come into play, and so just can you share with us, when it comes to transit, what percentage of our Oregon population enjoys the use of that? And this is just my own information. I'm sure I've heard it before over the last 3 months, but I have forgotten, because I'm just, with the money that goes into these things, I'm just interested in how many people actually end up using those types of services on a percentage basis.
Chair Beyer, Representative Bentz, I do not know that number. The way the Connect Oregon process worked was, in the considerations that were put in the bill as part of the application process, the experts in the modes, such as the Public Transit Advisory Committee, looked at the project, and our staff looked at the projects. Michael Ward's staff looked at the projects, and what they did was they tiered the project. So if it met all the considerations in the bill, it was Tier 1. If it met three of the considerations, it was Tier 2, and so on. And then they ranked, they prioritized them as high, medium, and low. And then within that, they ranked them. And it was that information, based on the expertise of transit officials or our transit staff, that went on to our region folks to look at primarily our area commissions on transportation filled that role, and they prioritized all of the projects across the modes. And then it went to the final review committee, and they had to look at it from a statewide basis, simultaneously making sure that at a minimum each of the regions received 10%, but then looking at what they did with the other 50%. So that was, they didn't really look particularly at the number of people that use the system, but rather looking at the experts, what they thought were the best projects that were being submitted. One of the things that we did do, though, was look at how many jobs were created as part of this. And I know in Connect One, based on construction as well as jobs associated with the project, we're at close to 1,000 jobs that have been created through the Connect One process. It's too early to really see what's happening in the Connect Two process because we really only have two projects that have been completed as of this point. So that's
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll attempt to help answer this too. I know in my district, Connect Two at least, a lot of public input on certain projects seemed to weigh in with the commission at the final hour. And even though, and I was showing Rep. Vance on the map, I'm about as far to the west as he is to the east. And they actually sent a delegation of locals over to the commission meeting thinking that if they marched in en masse, it would show how strongly they support certain things. And I can't tell you the results of all that, but I know that it did make a difference for the people, the local people, to weigh in, because a lot of people think this is all decided by people in Salem only, and it's not. So,
Chair Beyer, Representative Boone, you make a very good point, because one of the inconsistencies that we found between Connect One and Connect Two was the public involvement, and so it was very very clear about the consistency of allowing the public to provide comments through whether it was the modal discussion with committees or whether it was the regions or whether it was in the final review committee. We didn't have any of that, but they needed to be really clear and be consistent about how they allowed their public involvement, and that was one of the changes from the Connect One to the Connect Two that I think was very successful.
And follow up. Take that. Thank you. they intervened at the very beginning locally. They went through their ACT Committee on Transportation, and then they went on and they followed these guys around almost to the point of getting arrested for stalking at a point. But it worked.
Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you.
I'm distracted. And
oh, you're busy.
I know that as we went through the two processes, yes, as we went through the two processes, Connect Oregon 1, in Connect Oregon 1, there were items identified as ways to improve the process for selection. And then when we moved into Connect Oregon 2, in general, were people pretty happy with it? Were there any changes that people thought there should be made, or?
Chair Beyer, yes, I think they're very happy with it. One of the other thing that we did in Connect 2 was we did a final report that was actually signed by all of the members of the final review committee. And in that, some of them did recommend some changes to the process. And I think one of them that was probably of interest that gets to some of Transit's concern was recognizing perhaps in the application that we needed to do a couple questions that were mode specific so that those that were not knowledgeable about transit or those that were not knowledgeable about rail would have just that little bit more of information with regards to those projects. So that was probably one of the key items that came out that they'd like to see changed. But from a process standpoint, it appeared that everybody was fairly satisfied with the process.
Thank you. Any other questions? So now when someone asks you what Connect Oregon is, you can just spout it all off, everybody, right?
Jerry's
okay.
Number.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And Representative Gilman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Widener to vote on House Bill 3047 and House Bill 2564.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Gilman has moved to suspend the rules to allow Representative Widener to vote on House Bill 2564 and 3047. Any objections? Seeing none, the clerk will. What?
You can just ask him.
Oh, okay. Representative Widener, how do you vote on House Bill 3047?
No.
And Representative Widener, how do you vote on 2564?
Yes.
Thank you. And with that, committee, we are adjourned.